Okay, so we are going to get started and people will filter in as they get their notifications and stumble across the hallway. So I want to welcome everyone. We are going to be recording this session. We will be speaking with Rob Trusinski. Rob is a senior fellow at the Atlas Society. He is also the author of So Who Is John Galt Anyway? A Reader's Guide to Atlas Shrugged. He is the author of the Trusinski Letter. He's a longtime objectivist and has chosen an interesting topic for today's discussion. Thoughtfulness, mindfulness, reason as a spiritual discipline. Rob, I know you said it is an objectivist approach to reason as a spiritual discipline, but without the yoga mats. I'm not sure how to I feel about that because at the Atlas Society, we take yoga very seriously. We have Ayn Rand yoga mats, Ayn Rand yoga leggings, but hey, I live in Malibu, so I leave it
I
to
thought
you.
wasn't that Lululemon that they had a guy who was a Ayn Rand fan who was making
Yes,
yoga mats and yoga pants?
Chip Wilson was our honoree at the gala 2 years ago, and he spoke at last year's gala. And we did a Draw My Life. My name is Chip Wilson, which we've translated into over a dozen languages. And so, I think if it's supernatural, if it's superficial, it's not objectivist. But if it is about being centered and having a firm foundation, then I think that we can find some parallels. But let's hear your take on it.
All right, so I didn't actually mean to come out against yoga mats per se and as such. So if you want to have reason as a spiritual discipline with the yoga mats, you are free to do so.
Okay.
But yeah, there's no inherent contradiction in doing yoga. But what I wanted to get at with that is that I'm trying to sort of it's one part of my goal here to focus on some things that I think are sort of under-discussed aspects of objectivism as a philosophy. And one thing that I think objectivism hasn't focused on enough is, the advocacy of using reason is often sort of begins and ends with sort of an exhortation. You should use reason. And if it comes to the question of, well, how should I use reason? Well, then, okay, we'll do courses in logic and you can talk about logical fallacies and give all sorts of sort of technical advice. But the aspect I think has been missing is the fact that using reason is also has to be a habit. And it has to be a habit that you develop through use and through practice and through training. And I mean by habit, I mean a psychological habit. It has to be something ingrained in your psychology and ingrained in your subconscious. It has to be not just something that you remember, oh, I'm supposed to use reason. It has to be your automatized response to things to that you now. Reason itself is by its nature cannot be automatized. It's not just a mechanical series of things that you do, but the habit of there are certain mental habits you can do that make it easier to apply reason and to use reason and to not be driven by your emotions or not be driven by superficial appearances or what have you. And so that's what I mean by the idea of reason as a spiritual discipline, meaning that it has to be a series of ingrained habits. And I've seen this many times that I've wrote something about this recently where we're talking about cases, a lot of these cases where you have runaway political correctness and you see somebody, a bunch of the woke types protest over something totally innocuous and you see some administrator at a university just completely fold like a cheap lawn chair under the first touch of pressure. And you have to realize that if you said to this person, in theory, are you in favor of intellectual freedom, or do you think in moral courage is important? They would probably say yes to those questions if you ask them that as ex in explicit terms. But a lot of those people are also people who have been in comfortable positions where they've carved out a career that involves very seeking out a very low conflict way of doing things, and always getting along with people and always being liked by everybody. And because they've never sought out conflict, because they've always avoided conflict, because of the way they've lived their lives, they have not developed the habit of being courageous. You know, being courageous is not just a virtue, it's a habit. This is a very sort of Aristotelian take on it, actually, that, you know, we are what we repeatedly do. That's one of Aristotle's insights, that virtue is a habit and that you develop it through practice. So all of that is to say that rationality as a virtue is also a habit that you develop through practice. And it struck me, now, the way it struck me was because I'm sort of a Star Trek geek, and you can't stop me from doing that now because they just sent William Shatner into space. So there's no excuse that I have to not, you know, there's nothing you can tell me about. I have to shut up about Star Trek because they just sent William Shatner into space. So you're not going to stop me on that. So I thought of in Star Trek, they have, you know, the Vulcans are this alien species, you know, Mr. Spock being the prime example, who are supposed to be totally developed devoted to reason and logic. And in there, they had something I thought was intriguing, which is that they have a term, if Star Trek fans will know it, a term called kolinar, which is this Vulcan word for a discipline, a spiritual discipline, sort of a monk-like spiritual discipline that Vulcans are supposed to go through, in which they devote themselves to the pure obedience and pure adherence to logic and reason. Now, in the Star Trek version, because they're trying to sort of dramatize this philosophical idea of inherent conflict between reason and emotion, the way you practice kolinar is to purge yourself of all emotions. Although in later versions of the franchise, they amend that a little bit here and there. But so obviously objectivists, you know, with our view of the emotions, we're not going to carry that part over. But what I thought was intriguing about it was the idea of it being a spiritual discipline, of being something you practice the same way you would practice yoga. And, you know, we have in our culture this, you know, the term that I would love to use for reason as a spiritual discipline is mindfulness. But of course, mindfulness is already out there being used for something a little different. I mean, it has sort of yoga and it sort of yoga and meditation and a lot of these things that I think might have some value to them, but are also come with the baggage of association with Eastern. So it's this very mixed bag of stuff that's called mindfulness. But getting a lot of sudden feedback or something. Well, I'll assume that's not a problem. Keep going. So there's a lot of stuff that's called mindfulness that has this sort of baggage of Eastern mysticism with it. I would like to appropriate some, but it again creates the same idea of a spiritual discipline where you practice, basically practice calming your psychology and quote unquote centering your psychology, whatever that means. I think we need to have sort of an objectivist version of that where it's about how to integrate your emotions with your reason and to center your psychology around the use of reason and make that a habit that is formed and practiced through an explicit training. Instead of just the exhortation to use reason, it's the training, the habitual training to use reason in all your dealings and interactions with each other. So that's my case for sort of, I call it objectivist kolinar for the Star Trek fans, or reason as a spiritual discipline.
Well, I love it, actually, Rob. I've gravitated towards that without knowing your thoughts on it for the past 5 years. A couple of things I've wanted to do. I wanted to do a daily meditations for objectivists, taking a phrase from one of Ayn Rand's novels or nonfiction, and then figuring out like how to incorporate that into how one intends to apply that to one's day. We have our, you know, 365 days of Ayn Rand desktop calendar, but it's not quite the same. And I think that there is, you know, a need, a longing for something, you know, beyond novels, fiction, and philosophy, a way to apply them. So I'd love to hear from others Jason, perhaps you have some thoughts, or Dale, or Melanie. I see a Melanie in the room who's new. We want to welcome her. So,
well, I want to mention, you said meditation, and I think that's an interesting case where, you know, meditation, historically, meditation was a philosophical discourse, right? So, who's the Roman emperor? Marcus Aurelius wrote Meditations, or Descartes wrote Meditations on First Philosophy. So it was a philosophical discourse, was a meditation. And now, maybe my bias is I grew up in the 70s when it was transcendental meditation, and a guy sitting there with his legs crossed saying Om, you know, which seems like the opposite of engaging in philosophical thought. So I think, you know, reclaiming meditation and whatever aspects of that are valid, but combining it with this sense of thinking about philosophical ideas, I think that's sort of the direction to go.
Jason, do you have some thoughts?
Yeah, nice to meet you, Rob. Can you hear me clearly? I have these headsets on, these very expensive headsets. So as someone who's been teaching Ayn Rand for 25 years now to university students, I like the idea, Jennifer, that you just mentioned about, you know, using an Ayn Rand quote and then meditating on it. Because one of the things that I find myself, and I want to ask Rob his viewpoint on this, because I think it's probably a contradiction in Rand, maybe, I'm going to be humble here and say maybe, mm-hmm. is Rand said that emotions are not tools of cognition. But at the same time, she said that emotions are the result of the thinking one has done or one has failed to do, and that emotions are the result of an estimation or an appraisal that a rational person has exercised vis-a-vis another person, an object, a phenomenon, something in the world. Therefore, it seems to me that there should be no contradiction between reason and emotion, that they're in total harmony. If the thinking that one has failed to do produces a rational emotion, so therefore, can we not assume that a pure, a well-thought-out emotion, or let's just say a rational emotion that is the result of a series of habituated rational steps that one has taken is a tool of cognition, and that is an emotion is the manifestation, the final manifestation of a rational thought, and contains attributes of thought to them. That is, there's a thought component to emotions based on the steps that one has gone through to acquire, assuming that the emotion, of course, is rational, that one has gone through the thinking, not the failure to think, but the proper thinking that one has exercised or executed in the world that has produced a rational emotion. If that's the case, there seems to be no dichotomy between an emotion and a thought, and therefore emotions can be tools of cognition. And I've been meditating on that for a long time, because there's a class that I teach on the theory of emotions, and I use Nussbaum and lots of people in moral psychology. And then I try to reconstruct what Rand, to the best of my ability, what Rand has said. And I use it in the epistemology class, Rand's objectivist epistemology class also. But my question is, why could we not then think of rational emotions as tools of cognition, as having a thought component, a cognitive component affixed to them, if they're not the end result of a series of rational thought processes that one has gone through?
That's a really interesting question to bring up. My first pass on it, and I've got two examples from Atlas Shrugged that I want to pull out on this. So my first thought on it is that emotions are not tools of cognition, but they are, and I say they can be, but I think they are material for cognition. That is, I've often had the feeling of, you know, you feel a certain way about something, right? You have an immediate emotional reaction to something. And then the question is to say, well, why do I feel that way? What is that feeling telling me? Now, it's not that I'm using the emotional mechanism to do the thinking, but I'm using it as like, this has produced, the fact that I'm feeling this is information that I need to know, right? I mean, I had an example of this that My wife years ago got an offer to work for a client. She's an architect. She offered to work for a client. It was a really good offer, and a lot of things she liked about it, but she felt there was something really off about it and off about the person she was dealing with, and eventually decided to turn it down. And of course, it turns out finds out later that like the guy was embezzling money. there definitely was something hinky with the deal, and there was something hinky about the person there, but it was she experienced that, she sort of figured that out eventually, but experienced it first in the emotional level. We've all had that kind of experience, like I got a bad feeling about this person, and having a bad feeling is not in itself a conclusion, but it's grounds for further thinking. Or a good feeling, you know, love at first sight, right? It's a real phenomenon that people sometimes have met somebody and immediately had a good feeling about that person. And sometimes, now I think talk about love at first sight tends to benefit from selection bias, that, right? If you have an immediate good feeling about somebody and it doesn't work out, you don't remember it. But if you have an immediate good feeling and it works out, then you say, oh, it was love at first sight. But it can be, you have an immediate good feeling about somebody and it turns out you're correct. And it turns out to be, you know, somebody you marry or a lifelong friend or what have you. So your emotions are telling you information, but I would say they're not the tools for reaching a final conclusion, but they're the material for reaching a final conclusion. In Atlas, so I had said it, I do one example from Atlas Shrugged, the other one I'll save for a different point, but there, you may remember there's a scene, this is the Tim Taggart's wedding scene in Atlas Shrugged, where Francisco is giving his speech on money. He gives the money speech. And it's either, I think it's just after that, that there's this woman who comes up to him and says, well, you're wrong. It says, if you could refute anything I've said, madam, I'll gladly accept it. She says, well, I can't tell you why you're wrong. I just feel that you're wrong. And then Francisco turns aside to talk to Reardon. He says to Reardon, you're making the same mistake as that woman, but in the opposite direction. And what he means is that Reardon is ignoring what his emotions are telling him. So she's putting the results of her emotions, she's only listening to her emotions and shutting out her reason. Whereas what he's telling Reardon in that scene is, you are ignoring your emotions, you're putting aside your emotions and not paying attention to them and not figuring out what it is that they're telling you. And I thought that was an interesting example of how, you know, especially in her fiction, you see things that she doesn't always bring out in her nonfiction, but that are aspects of her philosophy that confirm, I think, what you're saying, which is the emotions are, your emotions, especially if they're properly formed emotions, are providing you information about the world that you need to be able to think through. And therefore, they shouldn't be ignored or dismissed. Now, I think I've got a clubhouse planned for next week where I'm going to be talking specifically about, much more about that issue in particular and about the emotions in general. So this is a good preview of that. But I think you're definitely on to something. Now, the other question is, how do you make sure your emotions are properly formed in the first place? And that's a whole other question, but go ahead.
Well, what I was thinking, Rob, is something that's more like an automated emotion that is a result of rational thinking. So let's say I have a family member, a cousin, and initially I have some sort of inbred familial affinity for or feeling of fondness for this cousin because I've just been socialized to think that one should feel fondness for one's family members. But after a series of observation and appraisal of her character, I realized that she's a nasty cretin, you know, medieval gargoyle, like a troll. And I've made that we have no values in common. And I develop an intense dislike for her. And every time I see her, I feel an emotion of either contempt or revulsion or just dislike. Now, what I'm saying by an automatized emotion is that I've already done the hard job of thinking. So when I see her, I don't have to go through the process. This is what I guess Rand would call conceptual economy. I don't have to go through the process of reexamining why I dislike her and revisiting all her disgusting traits and her bad habits. My emotion, my rational emotion, is serving as a tool of cognition right there because I can trust that the emotion is the result of a series of rational observations and appraisal. And in that sense, the emotion is functioning as a tool of cognition because it's been properly formed. And so when Rand says there's no contradiction between, for her at least when she was speaking, she said, I don't have an emotion that I can't account for. there's no contradiction between a rational emotion and reason, why then in that case with my cousin, I can't say that the automatized emotion is a tool of cognition in that moment?
Well, here's what I'd say. Then that's a great example, actually, because it actually does, you are using it as a tool. So let's identify specifically how the emotion is a tool of cognition. And I would say it's not so much that the emotion is delivering to you a conclusion that you didn't arrive at through some other means, but rather the emotion is a reminder of a conclusion. It's like an immediate and forceful mental reminder of a conclusion you've already made. Would that be a correct?
That's very, 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 very clarifying. Yes.
It's literally a reminder. I mean, it's doing what emotions are supposed to do. It's a thought being stored in automatized form.
Yeah, I guess in her journal, she calls it memory storing epistemology in the Ayn Rand journals. That's really helpful.
So what I'd also say is that I do think that introspectively, I do think you can tell the difference usually between an emotion, two different kinds of emotions. Sometimes you have an emotion reaction to something and you say, I know why I have this emotional reaction. Because the minute you have the emotional reaction, you're prompted by, that guy. Yeah, I had a bad experience with that guy. That's why I have this emotional reaction. But there are sometimes you have an emotional reaction. You're like, I don't know why. You actually don't know why you have the emotional reaction. And there is because your emotion is reacting to something that is below the conscious level. It's reacting to something subconsciously. And so, I mean, I've had that experience, like when you meet somebody that you, or take another example, there have been times when I've seen a piece of art that affected me. And sometimes it's been something like a movie or something like that, which I wouldn't have expected to affect me that way. And I have to think, well, why do I feel that way? Great example. I'm working on some stuff. I'm a big classical music fan. I'm a fan of Chopin, and I play Chopin on the piano. And I was trying to figure, I've spent a long time puzzling out why I like Chopin so much, because he's so gloomy, right? So a lot of his nocturnes, things like that, the stuff I love the most, his nocturnes, are basically him being decorously melancholy. Right, so he has this very sad and sort of tragic sense of life, and it's very the opposite of my sense of life. I'm an optimistic person. I have a sort of a much more of an upbeat sense of life, and I was trying to figure out forever why it is so I like Chopin so much, despite the fact that my sense of life differs so much from his. And it took me a long time to unpack this and figure out why it is. And I'll sort of leave people in suspense. But there's something else in his music that I was responding to. But it took me, because it's such a sophisticated thing, analyzing what is the nature of a Chopin nocturne, that it took me a long, long time to unpack all of that intellectually and figure it out. Now, in the meantime, I kept playing Chopin nocturnes because, I didn't feel bad that, I shouldn't love this stuff because it's so melancholy. But this is a case where it does take you a long time to figure out subconsciously what is it that you're really responding to in this. So there can be emotions that have very complex causes that you're not really sure why you feel the way you feel. And if that emotion is appropriate response or not. But I think that, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just, Scott, who is always keeping us company and is adding significantly to every one of our conversations, this one's a little bit different, so I wanted to bring him up on stage and see if he had a question or a take.
Yeah, Rob, I don't know if you wanted to finish your point.
No, go ahead.
Okay, great conversation. I love what you guys are talking about. I'm reminded, I think, when Robert Bidinato was with iOS many years ago, I think I had some tapes of his that were talking about kind of a rational rituals, if you will, of just You know, just kind of a personal story. I think I was in my 20s one time and really, you know, drunk or off balance and just saw a picture, you know, I'm in the restroom, there was a picture of the Beatles. I'm a big Beatles fan. So I just said, you know, law of identity, A is A, Beatles forever. And that kind of grounded me. And ever since then, that's just become like my thing that I say if I'm feeling off balance. And I just think that even though, you know, religious people may use that in a mystical way, I just agree that there's just a good place for people of reason to have something similar.
That's a great point. Go ahead.
So at this point, my idea of sort of rationality as a spiritual discipline is more an idea for this is something we need to have, and less a developed idea as to what it would consist of. And I think the idea of rituals, yeah, definitely rituals have that role and can, I mentioned earlier that an emotional reaction can serve as a reminder of a previously drawn conclusion, right? Like an immediate visceral reminder that you don't need to search, rack your memory for it, just pops up on its own and gives you this reminder of, oh yes, you don't like this person. Or yes, you do like this person on the positive side. So it can be a reminder of some previous conclusion that you've drawn. Rituals can serve the same purpose. They can be a reminder of a reminder to do something or to not do something. Can have a very powerful psychological effect. The area I want to investigate in this, though, is one of the examples I was going to draw from Atlas Shrugged earlier that I think is also worthwhile, and I wrote an article in which I mentioned this idea, so I used it there. Let me see if I can find the exact quote. It's right here. No, I don't have it with me. But it's in Atlas Shrugged, so slight spoiler alert, because I assume everybody here has read it, but it's at the scene where Dagny, very towards the end, where Dagny tracks down John Galt, and he's living in this garret in New York City in this poor neighborhood because he's just a track worker. And she finds him, and, you know, of course, it's a big mistake on her part because once she finds him, that the regime is going to track him down and they're going to arrest him. But at the same time, he also knows that her need to come find him indicates how much he means to her, so that it's a good thing. And there's this description that Ayn Rand gives about how his mind goes through this sort of lightning process of calculation, looking at the causes and consequences of the of this event. And, you know, it takes him a moment, and then there's his emotional reaction. And his emotional reaction is he smiles at her in greeting. So he's going through this and realizing, okay, here are all the causes and consequences of this event. And of course, because he's a genius, this all takes an instant for him. It might take the rest of us a little bit longer. But this idea of that the emotional reaction follows from this process of calculation, this habitual process of calculation. And I think that's an interesting key to it. So, and this is actually, when you think about it, because I have kids and they're now in their early teens, and so I've sort of watched this whole process happening. It's not quite done yet. But part of the process of growing up for a child is learning to mediate their emotional reactions. You know, a two-year-old has emotional reactions and he just has them. You have to work very hard to get any sort of reason mediating the emotion, right? Because they're just not capable. They don't have the mental capability yet to understand why they feel a certain way and to control that. But as they get older, part of the process of growing up is learning to coordinate and integrate your emotional reactions with your thinking. And so this, you know, John Galt is sort of showing in this case the sort of highly advanced adult version of it, which is that when a surprising new event happens, like Dagny Taggart suddenly showing up at his door, he has the habit of first doing this process of thinking and evaluation of saying what's happening, what are the causes of this, what are the consequences of this, what does this mean, and then having the emotion, and then sort of having the emotional reaction follow through that. And that's something I think we all go through as we become adults, is this process of not so much not suppressing your emotion, but slowing down the emotional reaction and integrating it with and mediating it through your rational faculty. And that's, I think, the key in Atlas Shrugged. One of the keys, I wrote about this in my book, because I think that's one of the keys to his character, is he has this sort of, in our modern parlance, we would always call it a Zen-like calm, right? He has this preternatural calm and serenity with which he looks at things. And the source of that is his ability, is his habit, his habitual method of thinking through the causes and consequences of everything that happens, and having that be what mediates and what integrates with his emotional reactions. So he's not suppressing his emotions, but he's integrating them with the actions of his reason.
Yeah,
and that gives that sort of serenity and calm that we would associate with some kind of spiritual discipline.
Yeah, can I just say one thing before sure. You invite somebody? Yeah, I think that's very helpful for me, Rob, because when I think of Galt in that scene, I think of how Rand articulated her notion of contextual absolutism. And so what Galt was able to do was to immediately transform what was a very subjective experience into an objective perspective against a backdrop of values that were absolutely unassailable for him. And realizing that Dagny in that moment is a value for what she stands for. But there's a particular context that is her characters are not Platonists. They're not these abstract figures there's a single metric that you can just use to evaluate every single context. I like the fact that she's a contextual absolutist. And when you unpack that and you use that example about John Galt, it made me think exactly of, when we talk about spiritualism, we all often think about a really subjective experience. But in the immediacy of that moment, he did have a subjective experience, but against the backdrop of his values and what those values meant to him or continue to mean to him, he was able to bring the subjective experience into a very, very objective perspective and then proceed with a concomitant emotional response that was very, very rational, I think. Am I right?
Yeah, and also you have to remember the part of the context for that scene is so this is after Dagny's been in the valley for a month, and then at the end of that month, they're all talking about what's going to happen afterwards. And there's this whole debate about, well, why is John Galt going back? Why is he leaving the valley? Has he achieved everything he's set out to achieve? Why is he going back out of the world? Why take the risk and why take the danger? And it's very clear that the only reason he's going back is for her, right? Is because of Dagny. And so that's the context for that scene. So when she shows up at his door, and where she, you know, she loves him so much, she couldn't bear to not know what's happened to him, and she had to find him. He's like, yes, this is what I came for. This is why I came back out here, is for this moment. So you can see the positive aspect of it for him. And why that would be something that would be a positive thing for him. But he's also evaluating the negatives as well. And then, you know, that process of just having the habit of, when a new event happens, immediately thinking through the causes and consequences and putting it in that context.
Part of it is strategic. You know, it's like he's just making all these assessments. Okay, she's here. They're going to follow me. I guess this is how it's going to go down now.
Yeah, but it's also he's putting it into the emotional context of the context of his values. So there's that, you know, there's the spiritual meaning of it for him.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, I mean, I think that's, you know, the smile's trying to convey all of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that was that scene actually is one of the things that sort of inspired this observation about reason as a spiritual discipline. Because I was trying to figure out what is it. So the title of my book, so who is John Galt anyway, is because one of the things I wanted to go into is who is John Galt as a character? Because I think there are some people sort of view him, and I think even people who like the novel, I know when I first read it, when I was, you know, the very, very first time through many, many years ago, I didn't really get the character of John Galt. I got Hank Reardon, and part of the reason is you see a lot more of the sort of transformation of Reardon's character. you spend a lot of time with the development of his character, whereas Galt sort of comes to you fully formed 2/3 of the way through the novel, right? So you don't see as much development. And so I think it's harder to grasp him. But I also think it's harder to grasp him because what he's meant to represent, what he's meant to embody, the essence of his character, is something that's actually very rarefied and difficult to achieve, which is precisely this idea, and I finally narrowed it down to this idea of this spiritual discipline that he has so automatized, this sort of willingness to accept the facts and all the facts and make that the center of his character, that it is a very, it's a very rarefied spiritual discipline to be able to achieve. Now, Ayn Rand never spelled out exactly how it is that you develop those habits, but she sort of showed us the example of the ideal version of it. So I think it's sort of up to us to sort of now, I'm just sort of beginning to gather my thoughts about how it is you would train for this and how it is you would achieve that and you know, teach it the way people teach quote-unquote mindfulness today.
Jason, maybe you could unpack for us, you mentioned Rand as a contextual absolutist. For the uninitiated, could you elaborate what you meant by that?
Well, in the sense that there are certain, in certain contexts, there will always be absolutes, right? So one absolute is that you have a right to bodily integrity, or you have a right to free speech. You have a right to property. So those are absolutes that are givens. They're unassailable in some sense. But the mere existence of the right, I think, doesn't tell you in any particular context how you might use your free speech or how you might use your property. So you have the right to free speech, but there might be a moment, for example, in a context, I think, and I think it might have been in the Fort Hall Forum where Rand spoke about this, but there might be a context, for example, in which no one has a right, barring libel, slander, false advertisement, shouting fine a theater, to prohibit your free speech. But let's say you're with a friend and it's a very delicate situation. Your friend is going through, you've just gotten a promotion at a job and your friend has been unemployed for the past year, trying very hard to find employment. You do have the right in that sense to, I think she would say, rationally boast or to celebrate your accomplishments. But a sort of tactfulness or a certain sort of, if she asks you, your friend might ask you, so how is your job search going? In that particular moment, judging the distress of your friend and how traumatized she might be or he might be not having found a job, you might choose in that moment not to exercise an unassailable right that you have because the context of the situation demands it. And why does the context demand it? Your friend is a preeminent value in your life. And in choosing not to exercise a right that you have in a particular context is up to your discretion. So the possession of certain rights and the possession of certain unassailable rights that we have in and of themselves don't always tell us how to apply them in certain contexts. And I think I heard Rand talk about this on the James Day program, Night and Day, where she talked about values being contextual. So that's part of what I mean. That's just one example. I mean, there are other examples that we could think of where just the mere possession of the right in abstract rights in particular contexts, you need to make other assessments and other appraisals about how to discreetly or not discreetly apply certain rights. I mean, we could talk about demonstrations, for example, if you're a conscientious objector in a particular situation, it might behoove you to just hold up a sign that says, I respect women's right to abortion, as opposed to yelling or screaming, because you might run the risk of, in that situation, being arrested by obstreperous police officers who will not respect your right. So the contextuality of the situation always demands that you, I think, determine how you are going to, in that situation, apply what is still an unassailable right that you have.
I get it. That's helpful. One of the things, you know, being compared to the two of you, much newer to the formal objectivist movement, that I like to say is to be objective, one must have perspective. And I think perspective, by that I mean, you know, missing the big picture or missing, you know, getting so lost in the particulars or the precise formula that you kind of fail to take account of the implications. But I wanted to bring Dana, who's been patiently listening, and by extension, I want to invite the rest of you in the audience. We also have our senior scholar, Professor Richard Salzman, Duke University. We have the chairman of the board of the Atlas Society, Jay LaPere. But Dana, we'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, it seems to me there's an urgency now that social emotional learning has taken over our elementary and college courses. So I think we need to figure this out pretty soon. Otherwise, there's a lot of pressure on people not to have free speech, because if they do, they'll lose, they'll get doxxed, they'll lose their jobs, and so forth. So I think we need to find a way to combat the indoctrination that's going on right now.
Dana, that's a great point, because what I want to recommend that I think Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt wrote a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. This is like 4 or 5 years ago, but it's worth looking up. And basically their argument is that with all the focus on emotional trauma, and you can't say this because it'll cause people emotional trauma, that coddling of saying you should, your whole life as a student should be organized around measures to prevent you from ever experiencing the slightest bit of emotional distress. They point out how, given what we know about psychology, what this actually does is it makes you far more sensitive to emotional distress. So I you know, Jennifer said, you know, sometimes in these, you know, saying in these clubhouse chats, are you prepared for people who will come in with hostile questions? And I told her that, you know, I have no problem with that, because my biggest advantage as a writer, especially about politics, is that my sister was mean to me when I was a kid.
Me too.
Now, we get along fine now, you know, but this is back when I was young. My sister was legitimately mean to me. And the thing is that there are a couple different reactions I could have had for that. You know, it could have been horribly damaging to my self-esteem. But the actual reaction I had with it is I learned to tune out hostility. And I have that skill to such a degree it astonishes other people. My wife, you know, like she grew up in Minnesota where she's, you know, you're very attuned. You have to be very attuned to people's emotional reactions because they're also muted, right? Yeah. People don't express their emotions loudly in Minnesota, so you have to be really attuned to all the signs. I'm not attuned to the signs. You know, you have to hit me over the head with a 2x4 to make me realize that you're being hostile. And it's great skill if you have to write about politics, because hostility is like the default mode for people's reaction when you start discussing politics. So just the ability to tune that out and not be affected by it is a great advantage. But the thing is, it's because, you know, being exposed to a negative allows you to cope with it and deal with it and learn how to achieve that serenity with it. And whereas constantly being shielded from it and told that it's a great injustice if you feel the slightest amount of discomfort is a great way to make you hypersensitive to discomfort and incapable of dealing with any kind of opposition or any kind of problem or any kind of frustration in life. And that was basically their argument in that book, that we're raising a group of people to basically be emotional cripples who cannot cope with the slightest difficulty or the slightest problem and melt down and need a safe space, you know, the minute that somebody with a wrong opinion or somebody with, you know, anything that upsets them, that they encounter that. So, I think that's the sort of the psychological aspect. We could talk about the political aspects of political correctness and wokeness on campus and that sort of thing. But the psychological aspect is that you are training people to have the opposite of what I'm talking about, the opposite of the spiritual discipline that allows you to put your emotions in context, you're basically training a whole generation, and have trained for some time, a whole generation of really hysterical emotionalists. You know, people who are just who are trained to believe that whatever emotion they have at that moment is the representative of the absolute truth. I used an example of this in an article recently. There was a case in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, in Phoenix, Arizona, there is apparently a Cornish pasty-themed restaurant. A Cornish pasty is like a meat pie from Cornwall in England. Why you would have a restaurant like this in Arizona, I don't know, but they have one. And somebody went in there, and decorating the restaurant is a bunch of photos of scenes from life in Cornwall, you know, traditional old-fashioned scenes of life in Cornwall. And one of them has a bunch of Cornish coal miners, because it's the major center of coal mining back in the day. Cornish coal miners with their faces all blackened by coal dust. And a guy comes in there and freaks out to the owner, says, "How do you, these people are in blackface. How could you have such a horribly racially discriminatory thing of these people in blackface?" Now, a rational person wants to explain, no, these aren't, and people aren't in blackface. That's coal dust. That's what happened when you worked in a coal mine. It's a natural thing. A rational person, a person with any ounce of this sort of spiritual discipline of reason, would say, "Oh, never mind. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that." Right? They would take the new fact in, and that would help them to change their emotional reaction. They'd have a different emotional reaction based on knowing different facts. But of course, this person went on and made a big stink about it, and wrote an op-ed in the paper, and all these things. And that is an example of how it's not just the content of politically correct ideas and woke ideas. It's what it does to people psychologically, is it makes them into these sort of raging emotionalists who are pushed around by whatever stray emotional reaction they happen to have at a given moment, and impervious to any factual and rational argument that would possibly cause them to change that emotional reaction, because they feel they have a right, an entitlement to that immediate emotional reaction, and to stick to that no matter what.
And once they do that to people often enough, it starts to bring out a reaction where they get more emotion.
Yeah, it's a cycle of hostility, right? You do that, you get a hostile reaction, and you say, "Well, see, I was right. These people are mean, are just trying to be mean to me." And you end up with the culture war we have right now.
Well, it seems to me that that's deeply rooted in philosophy.
Oh yeah.
And we can name the philosophy that advocates for those things, but it's collectivist for sure. So it seems to me we need to battle at the philosophical level as well as at the psychological and practical level.
Yeah. Yeah.
Professor Salzman is in the room.
Thank you, Rob. This is great. Quick question. The issue of mindfulness, obviously being mindful of our own status, of our consciousness and our what's going on internally, when objectivity entails trying to reach another mind, and where are they, especially if you're trying to teach them or reach them, can you say something, if you've thought about this, about the being mindful of your own mind and this other mind that you're trying to bridge, like a dual mindfulness? I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense, because a lot of what I do as a writer is I have to do my best to keep to have a model reader in mind, in terms of what is the state of mind of the reader I'm trying to reach.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are that person's questions going to be? What are his hot buttons? And sometimes, the thing I try to do, which I think is helpful but may just be annoying to some people, is try to sort of push the emotional hot button and then immediately follow it with, now let's taking that emotional energy and redirecting it towards a rational discussion of the underlying issue.
And partly
there's a commercial necessity to that, right? Because you have to get the audience. I wouldn't say commercial, but also just, there's so much stuff out there, so much material out there for people to read in the public debate, that you want to attract people's attention just to get them in the door. So sometimes you state something in a provocative form, and then you immediately have to switch to, all right, having said this in a provocative form, let me now then bring you around to having emotionally engaged you. Let me take that emotional engagement and transform it into an intellectual engagement.
So, sometimes you
have to very carefully gauge that for like, how do I emotionally engage them without just ticking them off and making them stop reading? But it's a lot of work required to understand where that other person is. One of the things I find interesting about the characters in Atlas Shrugged is the extent to which they are often very tolerant of someone who they perceive as being one of their potential allies, somebody on their side, who doesn't quite grasp an issue yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And saying, you know, from your perspective, I can see why you would think that. You know, there's a lot of right. Francisco spends a lot of time saying that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah.
And this is why, you know, I point out that this sort of reason as a spiritual discipline or objectivist culinaire that I'm arguing for, I think is something that the objectivism as a movement could use a little more of. I think there has been an attempt to, like, you know, what you said made me angry, and therefore and since my anger is rational, you know, because I believe I'm right, and therefore my anger is rational, therefore it's okay for me to be angry with you and to treat you in an angry way and to yell at you, et cetera. And it you have to take into account, well, this person, I think this person is wrong, but I have to explain why that person's wrong in a way that matches, that meets his context.
And yeah, or finding cases where, well, we seem to be disagreeing and disagreeing emotionally, so there has got to be a deeper philosophic chasm here. No, there isn't. No, you're just a little emotional. I also remember, you know, we used to be taught both in writing and in speaking. We used to be taught meet objections, anticipate the objections of others and everything. And I remember one time being stuck. I was talking to an objectivist. I said, you know, I'm trying to anticipate every goddamn thing this other person would come at with. And he said to me, Ayn said one time, listen, an argument can be foolproof, but it can't be damn foolproof. And I always thought that was so funny. You know, you can't reach damn fools. Anyway, it was great, Rob. Thank you.
Yeah. Actually, I want to say that the best compliment I ever got in one of my articles was when somebody said, you know, I really like that article because every time I thought of a question, like, well, wait a minute, but what about such? In the next paragraph, you answered it.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Thanks,
Rob. That's the ideal. That's, you know, I can always reach it, but can't always reach it, but that's the ideal I'm aiming for.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, I want to mention a couple of resources that we have at the Atlas Society pertinent to this conversation. One, Rob had referenced The Coddling of the American Mind, and we have an excellent interview with Greg Lukianoff. You can find that either on the video section of our Facebook page or go to the Atlas Society site and look at Now Playing. Also, our founder, David Kelly, wrote a recent pocket guide, 7 Habits of Highly Objective People, and maybe it's an encouraging sign of the times that is one of the best sellers at our student conferences, particularly those that are more mainstream and students don't, you know, haven't heard of Ayn Rand, that's a hook that they can gravitate towards. And it, I think also to what Dana was talking about, there's definitely a market need for it. We have about 4 minutes left, so I'm going to open it up. We could maybe take one more question. Otherwise, I'm going to open it to Rob, perhaps for some final thoughts, and then I'll just give some housekeeping notes.
Okay, does anybody else have anything?
I had a question. Just a brief question, sure. I wanted to ask you, Rob. There's a lot of work, philosophical work done on the role of anger, like Martha Nussbaum, whose work I know very, very well, has written a number of books and articles on anger as sort of that thing, following the Stoic tradition. And I was wondering if in your conception of reason as a sort of meditative practice, if, you know, one, at the end of one's reasoning process, one could not come to the conclusion that what I guess Aristotle would call righteous indignation, but something even more severe than righteous indignation, that anger would be a rational response. And how that, do you see that? Do you see anger as an emotion that is disruptive of this meditative approach to reason that you've so eloquently articulated?
Yeah. Well, I think anger can be disruptive if you let it be. That is, if you view it as not, okay, I'm angry, now why am I angry? You know, let's really put this in context. And now, if, like I said, emotion should be sort of integrated with and mediated through the rational faculty, so that I do think there's a lot of value in taking an immediate reaction of anger. And now, I know that none of us are actually it's very hard to actually do this 100% all the time. I don't say that no one can do it, but it's extremely difficult. I know I don't do it all the time. That there are times, when you have kids, sometimes you really shouldn't do it when you have kids, but it's also really difficult when you have kids not to like get angry about something. But so nobody's going to do this 100% of the time, but there's a good case for saying when you get angry, you should, count to 10, basically. You know, the old Thomas Jefferson said that. When angry, count 10. When very angry, count to 100. It's one of his rules for life that he wrote down. And I think there's a value to saying delay your reaction of anger. But then there are times when, after counting 10, you're still angry and there's good reason to be angry. When it's sometimes times when after counting 100 and writing a whole op-ed, you're still angry and there's good reason to be angry. So, I think that I mentioned that scene that with Francisco and Reardon, where he says, you're making the same mistake, but in the opposite direction. You're ignoring your emotions. And that's the scene where Francisco says to Reardon, there are no evil thoughts but one, except the refusal to think. And I think by the extension, because emotions are the product of thought, there are no evil emotions. I think that's what she's really saying, is your emotional reactions are not evil. The only thing that would be evil would be refusing to think about them. So in that case, anger is a perfectly reasonable emotion to have under the right circumstances. I mean, you got to go back to Aristotle. He said, I think he gives his interpretation of the mean in action, which is, to be angry at the right time and for the right thing. And that's really the early statement of that, that it's okay. Anger itself is not a problem. Anger as such is not a problem. What the problem is not putting the anger in a context of thinking that would either diffuse your anger. If you say, oh, well, now that I think about it, this person didn't really mean to offend me, or this, there might be some reason why you would, like the case, oh, well, these are coal miners and their faces are black, not because they're racist, but because they've been mining coal. You would take that new fact on board and your anger, we've all had the experience where you're angry about something and you realize that it doesn't mean what you thought it meant. And then your emotional reaction just disappears. It dissipates because you've integrated the new fact. So if the anger is not the problem. What the problem is the refusal or failure to integrate it with the facts and integrate it with reason. But to do so requires practice, it requires experience. And the big concern today is that you have a whole philosophy that's feeding people this emotionalism, and they're not learning even how, they're not practicing the discipline of figuring out how to integrate their emotional reactions with their reason. So that's sort of, the Vulcan discipline of Kolinar, but adapted not to suppress your emotions or purge your emotions, but to integrate reason, logic with the emotions.
Terrific. And I know this is a theme that we're going to be continuing next week with Rob's Clubhouse discussion. Again, every Tuesday, he's going to be making the case for emotions. And I am going to be paying particular heed because I'm sometimes accused of not having any emotions. one of my former boyfriends used to call me a robot. Of course, he was Brazilian, so to him, anything other than, constant drama was robotic. And then before that, on Thursday, for our weekly Thursday Clubhouse chat, we are going to have a conversation with Jay LaPere, He is, as mentioned, the chairman of the board of the Atlas Society. He is also CEO and president of Latrim Industries, which is a global manufacturing company. It does food processing equipment, conveyor belts, he's going to be talking about objectivist ethics. And then tomorrow, on our weekly, the Atlas Society Asks, we are going to be covering current events with Professor Richard Salzman and our founder, David Kelly. And last but not least, everyone, particularly if you are in the southwest region of the country, please consider joining us on November 4th. It is our 5th annual gala. Everyone up here on stage is going to be there. We're going to have all of our scholars and fellows. Antonella Marti is going to be joining us, and we are honoring Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal, and we'll also be hearing from Palmer Luckey, who is the founder of Oculus. So a lot of great stuff coming up. Rob, thank you for this conversation, and everyone, I'll see you tomorrow and possibly on Thursday.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, everyone.